Now, can you see? Signature somewhere, Bronte and Nelson. Yeah, there. There. The author Raleigh Trevelyan, in his book Princes Under the Volcano, makes a mention of a bluff man by the unlikely name of Lindemann, who was the British consul at Palermo. By whatever route, young Corlett of Cavalier found himself in Marsala and dared to intrude on Woodhouse's wine trade. Trevelyan writes, Woodhouse had no sympathy when Corlett found himself in financial straits. Joseph Gill, as he was now called, and I'll explain that in a minute, had joined his brother-in-law and was plunged into this cauldron, but seems to have got onto good terms with Woodhouse and the other two dominant characters, Ingham and Whittaker, who became in Sicily the equivalent, at least, of what Jardine Matheson's became in Hong Kong. And there you see some of the brands. There's Ingham. I can't see the others from here properly. But that's more or less a contemporary document. The firm, after their troubles, was reorganized as Gill and Corlett and is now a part of the Cinzano Group. Joseph, his wife, daughter, and one son remained and died in Sicily. Their daughter married a senior Ingham manager. But Joseph was anxious to give a Manx education to his two other sons. And since his brother, William, Marcia and Henry's third son, was now vicar of Malue and could house them there, he sent them to King William's College. This Malue vicar was the Reverend William, who changed the spelling of his name from Gell, with an E, to Gill with an I, probably because there was a clergyman at Lonnon, John Gell by name, who had been defrocked for misconduct. William's brothers all agreed and all became Gill, G-I-L-L. Now the elder of these two Sicilian boys, W.H. Gill, 1839 to 1932, jolly nearly 100, became celebrated in the island story by writing the words for the Manx national anthem, the Manx wedding, and the much-loved Manx fisherman's evening hymn, adapting the respective tunes from Manx airs. Even more treasured by many of us is the collection of native music and songs put together and edited by Gill in collaboration with his brother Deemster Fred and their close friend Dr. John Clegg of Arbury, whose lovely hymn tune Crofton displays Dr. Clegg's musical talent. W.H. Gill's working life was spent at the General Post Office in London. He was an artist and engraver of ability, and on retirement participated in the formation of the Manx Language Society. And he was commemorated on the Manx postage stamp, along with Dr. John Clegg, with its green fields by the sea, right? On the 24th of April, 1985. The younger brother, John Frederick Gill, studied law after leaving college with his cousin, James Gell, who later became Sir James Gell, entering into partnership under the style Gell and Gill Advocates. He became second Deemster in 1864 and a vigorous supporter of the hospital, close collaborator with PMC Kermode, and president of the Antiquarian Society. But like his brother, I suspect that his longer-term fame will rest upon the Manx National Songbook. But I want to return to then Uncle William. I would like to have time to tell you more about William. T.E. Brown wrote of him, "This man, perhaps the greatest of Manxmen I've ever met, was the Reverend William Gill, Vicar of Maloo, late Vicar of Maloo. He was one of our own men who came from the old Kinnay stock, and no man ever did more credit to his neighborhood. If you're interested, look him up in Manx Worthies. I have access to a copy of his diary for, the date seems to have vanished here, when he was 19, which makes the modern A-level candidate thank God for the passage of 200 years. I'll just read you one entry. "I propose to be up at 4 or 5 o'clock. Read scriptures in English and then in Manx. This to employ 2 hours. Then to study Euclid or logic or mathematics for an hour. Till dinner, read some useful English author. Then spend the afternoon studying Greek, Latin and Hebrew, 2 of these each day. After tea, write my journal and finish the day with a chapter of the Greek Testament and a hymn." Balaff, where the rector was the celebrated Hugh Stowell, was a natural mecca for ordinands. And William, in due course, married the rector's eldest daughter, Anne, and after ordination was appointed to the chaplaincy of St. John. There is Anne Stowell. Thence he became curate at Balaff, and to T.E. Brown's astonishment, took the lease of Ravensdale, in Balaff Glen there, intending to lease the house for boarding students studying for the university. In 1830, he was appointed Vicar of Maloo and remained there until his death in 1871. Bishop Short said of him, "If you want to buy a horse, consult Mr. Gill. And if you want to know about the management of a glebe, ask Mr. Gill." The fields round the vicarage stood tall with wheat. "A terrible hand at the weight," said the farmers. Here is an 1850s picture, a photograph of a picnic on Fort Island, and shows he was a great family man and indeed extended Maloo Vicarage to house his family. He had 4 daughters and 5 sons, but I'm just going to take an extra moment just to show you one or two of these people, because after all said and done, I'm not seeing very well from here, but that clearly is William, right? And the lady, she a black hat there? That's Mrs. Tom Moore of Balaun. That is Anne Stowell Williams' wife, and that is their eldest daughter, Amelia, who married James Gell, who became Sir James Gell, and that is their eldest child. That character, looking like something from Dickens, is Deemster Fred, and that chap there is a rather celebrated Canon Hugh Stowell, who was a tremendous evangelist parson in Salford near Manchester. So one of the others is Mrs. Genest and so on. It was, you know, a Maloo parish party of young people. He had 4 daughters and 5 sons, 3 of whom became clergymen, and 1 yet another lawyer in Gellengill Castletown. William Gill and Anne Stowell leave an unusual memorial. They had 2 servants at Maloo Vicarage, Jane Clegg and Janet Walkington. When William died, Anne and the 2 women moved to the Green. And when Anne died in 1886, the two servants bought the house on the corner, at the end of the road, and set up a shop there. And the survivor was Janet Walkington, who lived until 87, dying in 1921. And today, her memory is perpetuated in Janet's corner. The lawyer's son, Henry Corlett Gill, had a son, Frank, who joined the National Telephone Company of Great Britain and rose to become its chief engineer. Where's my lawyer? Blimey, we're out here somewhere. There's William. Frank should be here somewhere. Is he there? He became chief engineer, and when it was nationalized in 1911, Frank Gill refused to accept nationalization and resigned. He served during the Great War in Winston Churchill's Ministry of Munitions, and after the war was recruited by the gigantic American concern AT&T as vice president. He was then involved with and was the first person to speak on the transatlantic telephone service when this was established in 1923. He became chairman of Standard Telephones and Cables, president of the Institute of Electrical Engineers, and also of its European equivalent. Created KCMG, Sir Frank Gill died in 1950, loaded with foreign honors, including Spanish, Japanese, and Chinese. We have no time for the three clergy sons of William. The eldest also had three clergy sons, one of whom became a colonial bishop. And here you see his crest with the motto, Siech Ajaro, which means peace at the last, which is an appropriately Episcopalian motto, and you see it supported by a couple of herrings and a herring gull above. The second son, Hugh Stowell Gill, followed his father at Molloy and in 1895 became archdeacon. He was the last holder of that office to sit ex officio on the Legislative Council. When it became vacant, the archdeacon had been offered to T.E. Brown, who was his cousin, through the mother of Reverend Hugh Stowell Bullough. Brown declined with a brief verse. Gill for archdeacon, sound the fiat clear. Manxman he, and Manx-like loves the Manx. A stranger's voice my people will not hear. Let them hear Gill's grand voice and give God thanks. He celebrated his golden wedding in 1908, and he and his wife died at Andreas in 1912. They had one son who emigrated to Western Australia and remained there, and eight daughters. Seven are shown here. Oh, blimey, that's the golden wedding. Sorry, we're running a bit late on the script. That's the golden wedding. There's Andreas Rector. There are the eight daughters, seven daughters. There are the seven daughters at the golden wedding. And for interest, the next to the right became your speaker's mother. The third clergy son, Thomas Howard Gill, deserves and received a book all to himself. Becoming Vicar of Worley Range, Manchester, now part of the sad Moss Side, he built up an average Sunday evening congregation of 1,100. He invited Moody and Sankey to campaign there and then wrote to his mother, to see a church that seats 2,500 full, sometimes night after night, was marvelous. Posted as English chaplain to Paris, he had the cheek and influence to organize a meeting at the Mansion House in London to raise money for a parochial hall. He reminded the city merchants that the French are possessed of the idea that no man understands a horse like an Englishman, and that English nannies are in great demand. He was concerned, he said, to provide the means to counteract the many evil influences which surround them in Paris. He asked for and got £12,000, which I calculate to be roughly £500,000 in today's money. And finally, as vicar of Tunbridge in Kent, he was again a building and had the audacity to secure the presence of Princess Beatrice, Queen Victoria's youngest daughter, to ensure a successful result. And so last of all, we go back to Agell, to James, the second son of John Gell and Margaret McCutcheon, whose father died when her three boys were still small. His mother determined that the eldest boy should succeed to Canet, and that the second should take up law, for which her brother, the Deemster firms, offered the opportunity. The third boy, Philip, whom I've mentioned as having gone to New Zealand, there you are, all arranged with Thomas Hardgill. Third boy, Philip, whom I mentioned, went to New Zealand and in due course retired to the island, where in his later years he became a director of the Steam Packet Company. William Cubbon wrote, James Gell was the most distinguished lawyer who ever sat in Tynwald. Entering King William's College in 1837, which you'll note was extremely early, he was admitted to the Manx Bar in 1845. In 1850, he married the vicar of Malew's eldest daughter, his cousin Amelia, thus, as he said, putting her eye out. He became High Bailiff of Castletown when he was 31 and Attorney General in 1866. That is Amelia. This was an important moment. Governor Locke had barely been in office 3 years, and he was determined to make the Keys an elected body. Whitehall offered conditional financial concessions if the Manx would agree thereto. William Drinkwater, the first Deemster, and James Gell were confronted by strongly held opinions, perhaps illustrated by William Collister's denunciation. It just comes to this. We are to spend the money just as they, the British government, tell us, and the idea that representatives of the island will have the right to spend it is all moonshine. The Deemster and Attorney General fought tenaciously but impartially for the island's right to spend its own revenues. Agreement was eventually reached and the Election Act passed in December 1866. That is Governor Locke. Kinvig wrote, it was the turning point in Manx history and ushered in the modern phase of the national development. The two lawyers may be said to have been the godparents, and Governor Locke recognized their service by recommending both of them for knighthoods. There is Sir James Gell having got his knighthood. There it is. Right, now we'll have the next picture. You may recognize this picture. In midsummer 1902, Edward VII had an appendix. The coronation had to be postponed to the 9th of August, and public anxiety was beautifully expressed by the poet laureate in the indelible lines, over the wires, the electric message came. He is no better. He is just the same. The governor, Lord Henniker, had died, and his successor, Lord Raglan, was not yet chosen. The Crown appointed Gell acting governor, in which capacity he presided over the 1902 Tynwald ceremony. In the third week of August, Edward and Alexandra embarked on the Victoria and Albert for a convalescent cruise. And they are photographed on the 25th at Bishop's Court with Bishop Stratton. You will see James Gell and Speaker A.W. Moore on the bishop's right. Now, you will also note one or two other little interesting things. Oh, by the by, the occasion resulted in the bestowal of the Commander of the Victorian Order on both Gell and the Speaker. The other interesting things, the two people with the hats on, other than the King. One is there, and one is there. That chap was the Marquis de Sovereign, who became a very great friend of Queen Alexandra, and after Edward's death, was helpful in keeping her income and all the rest of it alive. And I think perhaps during the King's life had other duties connected with Biarritz and places like that. The other chap is Derwent Hall Caine, standing next to his bearded father, Hall Caine, who had at least had the decency to take his off. Now, on the left is, gosh, I've forgotten the name and I know it so well, Alice Keppel, the King's mistress, whom Queen Alexandra, you will remember, when the King was dying, sent a message and said, Alice, I think you had better come and see Edward because he is dying. And on the right is her husband, the Honourable George Keppel. And those of you who are as old as I am may discern somewhere in the background here Austen Chamberlain, who was Home Secretary, and I think that is Haldane. And I'm pretty sure that is a chap who became my godfather, Canon Moran, who was principal of Bishop Wilson's Theological College. We're on the last page, you're all right. Sir James died while on his knees during the Lord's Prayer at St. Mary's Castletown on the 12th of March, 1905. He had followed Drinkwater as first Deemster in 1897 and succeeded Sir Alured Dumble in April 1900 as Clerk of the Rolls. Sir Spencer Walpole, Governor 1882-1893, wrote, "The island may have produced men of greater ability, and though this is hard to believe, of greater industry. But in the long centuries of its past history, it has never been represented by one who had a more intimate knowledge of its constitution, or who was animated by a deeper loyalty to its people." He has a page in the Dictionary of National Biography, one of a small number of Manxmen thus complimented. I would have liked to tell of a couple of daughters, just to balance the feminist era. Annie Gill, granddaughter of the parish parson, who in the Great War was matron of the Edinburgh Royal Infirmary, was made a CBE and became president of the Royal College of Nursing. And somebody much nearer home to most of you, Dr. Mary Gell, great-granddaughter of John Gell and Mary McCutcheon, who became a gynecologist of distinction, practiced her profession as a missionary in China, and after the World War II, to my astonishment, when I went through her papers, became one of five founders of War on Want, along with George Lansbury and others, founding directors. She never talked about it. I am sure that the English merchants, the revestment, and Lord Locke's reforms, each in their day, caused much anxiety and resentment, just as we've had resentment in the last 25 years or so from time to time. But have we not seen that these winds of change blew open doors of opportunity where the innate talents and character of the Manx people were enabled to flourish? And today I would suggest we are witnessing something akin, and it seems to me certain, that our younger citizens and their children will take advantage of these fresh winds of change to take our islands to new heights of prosperity for all, with no need to emigrate either for education or advancement in business. Thank you very much, Linda. And I did say a quarter past, did I not, to some inquirer with the taxi. So you're all right. Indeed.
And it was meticulously prepared and obviously timed as ever. But particularly, because I've worked with Stone Canyon really for quite a long time, in fact, all your time on the island, it seems, through all sorts of historical projects, which range from the preparation of the Miss Gibbs reminiscences on tape, just in a purely sort of facilitating record, I should say, and also preparing the history of the Gibbs of the Grove and humbler tasks like projecting the slides for your Kirby tour. I think we've been involved in many, many historical projects together. And I'd particularly like to record publicly my great appreciation of all you have done for Manx Historical Studies. You're a great enthusiast, and perhaps best of all in Manx context, you're a very great achiever. Now, I'm waiting, holding myself in readiness to hear your next study project. But in the meantime, I'd like you all to join in appreciation of a very special lecture. Thank you very much.
Well, Anne, that is very, very kind of you. Thank you. Right, finish.